Godspeed Institute, an enlightening and positive forum exploring all the world's religions and spiritual belief systems as an on-air classroom in an effort to help people better understand each other, promote tolerance, and foster peace. I'm your host, Care Hallenbeck. Mirabai Starr is an adjunct professor of philosophy and world religions at the University of New Mexico, Taos. A writer, speaker, and translator, she is well known to readers for her acclaimed translations of the mystic works Dark Night of the Soul by John of the Cross and The Interior Castle and The Book of My Life by Teresa of Avila. Her latest book is God of Love, a passionate and personal exploration of the interconnected wisdom of the three Abrahamic faiths, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. In it, she shares an overview of essential teachings, stories of saints and spiritual masters, prophetic calls for peace and justice, and for the first time in print, engaging narratives from her own spiritual experiences. Mirabai, welcome to the program, and thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Care. I'm delighted to be here.
Well, now first, can you tell us a little bit about yourself as a way of laying down a foundation for today's talk? There's a universal quality that has infused your work. How did it evolve?
There's nothing special in particular about my life or who I am, except perhaps that I grew up in a counterculture environment, meaning my parents removed our family from mainstream America in the very early 1970s. We lived in suburban Long Island, New York, agnostic, middle-class Jewish family, and moved us as part of this wave of back-to-the-land, communally-oriented counterculture to the mountains of northern New Mexico, and where I still live, by the way. And here in New Mexico, it's a deeply sacred place, as you and many of your listeners probably know. It's always been a crossroads of many different tribes and belief systems, and kind of almost a safety zone where everybody could come together and lay down their differences. And that tradition seems to have evolved and continued over the centuries, so that by the early 1970s, when we moved to northern New Mexico, there were literally representatives of every religion on the planet living here and practicing their religion here. You know, the other day I spoke to an old friend from high school, which was a very long time ago, and I was remembering with her when we were in high school. She's half black, half white. Her father's black and her mother's white. She told me a story in high school about a birthday party she had when she was a little girl, and the kids came to her birthday party, and one kid said, "You have one of each," you know, meaning a black father and a white mother. And she said, "Doesn't everybody?" And that's how I feel. It's like, doesn't everybody have and love all the world's religions? So, yes, it's just by virtue of the fact that I grew up being exposed to, in a spirit of, you know, tolerance and love, all of the world's spiritual traditions, and it's just how I was formed.
Well, that's a really miraculous and kind of mysterious thing about the part of the world where you live. The land is so stark and so beautiful, and there's a purity there. You've never seen so many stars as down there.
And yet I think, you know, doesn't everybody know this magic in their bones?
Well, that's a good beginning place here. Perhaps people know deep down, and we respond to the magic, for example, in all the stories and movies that are made about it. You know, Harry Potter, for one, the most huge hit. People are responding to Lord of the Rings and all the mystery out there, but somehow disconnected from in our day-to-day lives over the decades and centuries, but still very hungry for it and thirsty for it
exactly,
as a kind of truth.
Yeah.
Now, that said, I can relate somewhat to what you just shared. As an adult, my family moved from the New York City area up here to Maine, you know, similarly, and kind of moved out from that mainstream culture as well, and raising our children here today in that kind of, you know, slightly different world with different priorities.
Yeah,
and embedded in nature,
yeah,
such as it is. They say here, if you don't like the weather, wait 5 minutes.
Wow, I'd love to see it. It sounds so beautiful and wild.
But now, you know, as a child in your history there, were you raised with any kind of focus on spiritual awareness with your parents, or was it more diffuse, as you said, and secular?
Yeah, I think my parents were definitely vocally anti-organized religion.
Okay.
They were Jewish, but were part of that that generation of people who sort of post-Holocaust Jews,
yeah.
I think, who couldn't get around the idea of a loving God who would allow such suffering, and therefore threw the baby out with the bathwater and rejected
right.
religion altogether. However, I definitely grew up with a strong sense of spiritual awareness and appreciation. My parents were much more open to the Eastern religions and philosophies, as they called them. Philosophy was a
right.
safer term than religion. And did some practice of meditation, and my father read tarot cards, and they were, you know, they had a feeling for the sacredness of the earth and the importance of being open to other human beings in a loving way, and very heart-centered people, but really suspicious of organized religion. And I, on the other hand, was drawn to every single religion I encountered, not so much the more new iterations or expressions of spirituality, but ancient, like the more ancient, the better.
Yeah.
These kind of rooted religious traditions, particularly in their monastic expressions. Like any time I would see anyone dressed in a particular garb that was associated with their religion, whether it was a turban or a robe or whatever it might be, I just felt this answering response in myself, almost of longing for that, and yet was never tempted to join any particular religion to the exclusion of any other. I mean, I might have been tempted, but never very much. There was something in me that always said, they're all beautiful, they're all true, and if you pick one to the exclusion of the others, you're violating the covenant, whatever that covenant might be, an invisible covenant in my heart that puts God in, that is not allowed to put the divine
right.
in a box.
Right, it's more like choosing sides then.
Yeah,
Eliminating so the others.
Exactly, and so there's always been this kind of tension in me of this deep attraction to religion and respect and appreciation for religions, unlike, you know, my parents. But also probably some embarrassment about that because my family was so intellectual also, and, you know, which is a very Jewish tradition
yeah.
to discern and to argue and wrestle with ideas. But it just would have been really, really hard to become a fundamentalist anything with the kind of rigorous intellectual orientation of my family.
Right, right. Well, that makes sense. But you were nonetheless drawn to something very ancient, and of course, the religions, especially in your earlier times of history, very connected to the earth and
right.
somehow greater than ourselves, and probably that mystique,
yeah.
you know, and that feeling of that mysterious power sounds like it attracted you always.
Yes,
you know.
And I've always had those kind of monastic inclinations. I mean, I'm married with children and now grandchildren, and I love my life as a householder, as they say in the yogic tradition.
Yeah.
But I have always needed, from the time I was a little girl, long hours of silence and solitude and reflection and get very easily overstimulated by the world and noise and lots of people and activity. Can't deal with television.
Right.
My nervous system just seems like it was designed for someone in ancient times.
Well, yes, and even television has changed so much during our lifetime. It's frenetic at this
yeah.
point with very short segments of content.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we had a little benefit of some longer time frames when we were younger, but even so.
Wow.
Now, were you raised, did you grow up simply in a community in in New Mexico, or did something called the Llama Foundation play a role?
Right, right. So, okay, so my parents lived communally always. Mostly our house was the hub. We always had people living with us and coming and going. But when I was around 12, we were all, my whole family, all of the children, were going to an alternative school. In those days, it was called a free school. That was very much an arts-based curriculum, a very experimental, child-centered, very creative curriculum, not very academic. And when I was around 12, Llama Foundation, which is only about 20 miles from my home in Taos, New Mexico, took over running the school. And when Llama began to run this school that had already a strong tradition of alternative arts-oriented education, it included a kind of exposure to different spiritual traditions, Buddhism, Hinduism, Sufism, Native American traditions. And I was so drawn to what was going on at Llama. We started to spend time in the mountains. Llama Foundation is one of the original interspiritual, intentional spiritual communities on the planet,
okay,
along with, say, Findhorn in Scotland.
Right.
And it's the place where Ram Dass wrote Be Here Now.
Okay.
His very famous, groundbreaking book, which is just like a cultural icon now, that really introduced Eastern thought to a modern Western world in 1970. So Llama has always been a kind of hub of that kind of activity, and when I began to go spend time there, and it's way up in the mountains, by the way, it's been off the grid before off the grid was ever even
right,
at all a mainstream concept.
Yeah.
So a place of no running water or electricity, you know, hauling water, building fires, living very, very simply and close to the land, and lots of hours of meditation and different spiritual practices. And I was just like a moth to the flame, even as a 12, 13-year-old. And when I was 14, my first love, my first boyfriend, died in a tragic accident with a gun, and it blew the ground from under my life. You know, it shattered me completely, and it's such a vulnerable time anyway, 14.
Yeah.
And I experienced it as a spiritual awakening, really, of sorts, although when you're 13, how much time have you had to go to sleep? But there was an awakening involved. It was a shattering awakening, but something nonetheless opened in my soul, and all I wanted was God. And I ended up moving to Llama Foundation that summer, the summer of my 14th year, and leaving home. Of course, home wasn't far away, but it was a pretty radical act. My parents were supportive because they, although they couldn't really relate to my thirst and hunger for spiritual life, they respected me somehow and always had treated me with respect. And I had started writing poetry at a very young age, and they had always been extremely supportive of that and affirming of some kind of innate wisdom that they saw in me. I mean, in some ways, I wish they had been a little bit more parent-like and authoritative.
Really, in terms of boundaries?
Said, you know, maybe not, because some things also happened to me from making that choice that probably weren't so healthy, because, I don't know, people weren't as aware in those days of certain boundaries that we're aware of now regarding relationships between younger people and older people, for instance.
Yeah, but at the same time, it sounds as though they really could relate to the grief you were experiencing.
Right,
and
as a matter of fact,
that was a priority.
Relate, because my older brother Matty had died of a brain tumor just a few years before. When he was 10 and I was 8, we were still in New York. My brother died of cancer, and so my parents were still in grief, as a matter of fact. So I think that's very true, Kara.
Yeah, you know, that must have been a very formational experience for you to be living at Llama Foundation for a while.
Yeah, and it was, you know, truly an immersion in Hinduism, Buddhism, and Sufism, a little bit Jewish mysticism. Reb Zalman, known now as the founder of the Jewish Renewal Movement, who's very much an elder now, he came to Llama and taught us about Jewish mysticism and Kabbalah and the Shabbat, the weekly Sabbath, as a very sacred and important practice, which I have continued to this day, by the way.
Yeah.
When we had Thomas Keating come, Father Thomas Keating, who is the creator of centering prayer, which is a major movement in contemplative Christianity, and he came and taught us all centering prayer and did beautiful rituals of washing the feet in the tradition of Jesus and the disciples.
Yeah.
So I was exposed over and over again. I spent a lot of time as a teenager with Ram Dass, and in fact left Lama to follow Ram Dass when I was 15. And so, yes, it was, I sometimes say I feel like the Forrest Gump of the spiritual world. I just was in the right place at the right time to be exposed to all of these great teachers and teachings that are now so entwined with my own past that I can't even separate.
Well, I like the Forrest Gump analogy, because then you could say, you know, religions are like a box of chocolates.
Right? And I think we're not only allowed to pick and choose the,
yeah,
you know, the flavors that we respond to, I think we're supposed to. We are endowed with the faculty of discrimination that says, you know, don't eat the bad ones, eat the good ones, and make of that feast an offering to the world.
Hmm. Thank you for that. It's well said. Now, then, how did interspirituality, as like the phrase in your descriptions about your work, how did this become your work? What drove you
right,
to make this a focus of how, not just how you live your life, but, you know, what you're now sharing?
Well, as you know, and your listeners may or may not know, most of my books have been translations of the Christian mystics, particularly St. John of the Cross, Dark Night of the Soul, and St. Teresa of Avila. They were Catholic in the monastic tradition, Carmelite tradition from Spain, 16th century. And I'm always, in all my books, I have always had this impulse, because I think of the way I grew up and of my own spiritual inclinations, to make connections between all of the world's religious and spiritual traditions and to make my translations accessible to everyone, regardless of faith tradition or lack of faith tradition. You know, many people read my books who are not in anything in particular and yet respond to the kind of perennial wisdom in these mystics. So I've always had that inclination. I also teach world religions at the University of New Mexico in Taos, and it has been my mission for the last 20 years to show my students the interconnectedness of all the world's religious traditions at their heart, even though when I trained in graduate school, that was considered to be kind of silly, you know, looking for the universal connections was like what amateurs did, and real scholars, you know, would look for the diversity and emphasize what makes each religion so different and unique, culturally, historically, and so on. But then I see Houston Smith is one of my idols, one of my great heroes. He wrote The World's Religion, which is the most read world religions text on the planet. And he said, you know, there are plenty of people talking about the wars and the horrendous history of different religions and concentrating on all of the differences that divide them. And he said, you know, my task is to look for what unifies them and let the other people take care of that. And that gave me permission to do my version of the same thing, which is to celebrate the unity at the heart of all the world's religious traditions. And right now, Kerr, as you obviously feel too, because I've paid attention to what you have to say on the matter, it's vitally important for us to find the unifying wisdom of all the world's religious and spiritual traditions, because we're so fragmented. I mean, at the same time that we have this globalization phenomenon and communications are possible between all people everywhere, there seems to be more dangerous division and fragmentation and fracturing of the human spirit into little boxes and defended positions than ever before.
And I really appreciate you sharing that, because that is exactly, you know, what we do here.
Yeah.
Every week, and in our third year now, most of the time in the media, the conversation on religion is a very stilted, who's right, I'm right argument. where people are, you know, cutting each other off and not listening. And, you know, that's exactly what this hour is for and dedicated to. And we make a real point of that, that this is a time of listening and getting to know one another. Because in almost every program, the more we listen to what someone says, the more we wind up on the same page.
Right.
And discussing the kind of things we're going to get to as we focus more on your book in the second part of the hour. But yes, I mean, you know, mostly out there, I mean, Houston Smith, of course, is correct in it's more of a war about religions.
Yeah.
And what's wrong with everybody, and as you mentioned earlier, throwing out the baby with the bathwater.
Yeah.
But when we tease out the spiritual core and teachings of, you know, most faiths worldwide, even, you know, in our exploration of atheism on the program.
Yes.
When we hear each other out, and by the way, in my studies and my research, I learned about the etymology of the word obey. Which has a bad rap in the West.
Right.
To be obedient is somehow confused with being submissive or humiliated.
Right.
Somehow, but the root of the word comes from the French and the Latin, meaning to give ear to listen to.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, 13th century term.
So, beautiful.
You know, we're being obedient here in a very, you know, authentic meaning of the word.
You exactly.
know, we hear out our
I
neighbors.
Love that.
We hear out our neighbors and learn about each other. Now, let's talk a little bit though about the translations, because that's rather unique, and your translations are really hailed and acclaimed. And these works have been translated previously. So, so what were you drawn to in terms of, like, the significance of crafting your translations of these works? Was there something missing, or something you felt needed to be better honed for readers?
Hard to say what I'm saying without sounding presumptuous, because the previous translations of, say, St. John of the Cross and St. Teresa of Avila were very beautiful and important works. But neither John nor Teresa had been translated in decades. You know, John of the Cross was in the 1930s and 50s, and Teresa about the same time by the same people who were
right.
happened to be Catholic priests, men.
Yeah.
And so it was just time for a fresh contemporary translation of these great mystical masterpieces so that they would be read by people other than scholars and really serious Catholics, which are about the only people who were reading them. Sometimes somebody would give somebody else a copy of the older translations of Dark Night of the Soul when they were, you know, going through a time of spiritual crisis, and the poor person going through the crisis would try to read these really arcane translations and say, this is just making it worse. So I was teaching Dark Night of the Soul in my college humanities classes in translation, and my students were not connecting with it at all, whereas I had read it in Spanish when I was studying in Spain in my early 20s. I did a semester abroad, well, I was 20 actually, and I encountered John of the Cross in the Spanish literature class in Spain.
Wow.
And I had already been exposed to Rumi. This was long before Robert Bly or Coleman Barks had created these contemporary new very readable translations. I had read Rumi as a Sufi teacher, you know, as being a Sufi master, when I was a young Sufi student. And when I encountered John of the Cross, it was like, oh my God, he's the Rumi of Spain, on fire with love for God. And so I was teaching not too many years later and trying to get my students excited about this very powerful text, Dark Night of the Soul. In fact, it remains the single most influential spiritual text in my life. And they weren't getting it. Now, I know we need to wind up soon, but I also am a writer first, really. I guess I haven't said that, but I am a writer's writer. I love language. I love the beauty of language. My parents were both writers and readers. And so it was really important to me to craft a translation that was not only accessible spiritually, but beautiful to read.
Yes, I can understand the frustration, too, when a text is so meaningful to you that it's not translating to your the students you want to pass it on to.
That's right. So I really approach the translations both from a, you know, a spiritual standpoint of these teachings are so important, and an aesthetic one, like that the language would sing on the page. And so I hope I have. And also that, thirdly, that it would be universally relatable.
Well, it's very important, too, because, you know, on the one hand, you know, Joan of the Cross is very lofty, beautiful writing, mm-hmm. and Teresa is more vernacular, more straightforward, as she was, much more down-to-earth, but they're both mystics, mm-hmm. and they both worked and lived in this world, and they both, you know, had to build and reorganize their organization, and there are lots of things in there that are very helpful to people.
That's right.
The ways they got along, the ways they didn't, but it didn't stop their relationship.
Exactly.
So it's a, you know, I can understand you're wanting to go that extra mile to.
And because I speak Spanish, I had that additional impulse, you know, that I was able to relate to this in its original language and convey it from that place. I actually just finished, literally this week, translating Julian of Norwich from medieval, you know, Middle English to contemporary English, and it's very similar to translating Spanish because it's a language I know, but it's in a very unfamiliar form.
Wow, well, I'm going to look forward to that.
Thank you.
You're reading that.
It'll be out in the spring.
So let's talk about mysticism then. It's common to all the people you're drawn to, basically.
Mm.
We discuss it fairly often on the program, but what do you find in mysticism, and why is it important today?
Well, it's really, to me, it's very important today, vitally important for a similar reason to what we were speaking about earlier in these very fragmented times with everybody putting up their walls between their religions and their ideologies. Mm-hmm. Mysticism is about having a direct encounter with the divine, with the sacred, with God. And the mystics of all traditions, different religions and faiths, have reported what it is like for them to drop all of the intermediaries and all of the techniques and definitions and have a naked heart-to-heart experience of that which transcends all boundaries and yet is the source of everything. Love. And that's why the language of romantic love is so often used in the mystical literature, because there is this intimacy and there's this nakedness that happens when the mystic has that rendezvous with the beloved. And so it's mysticism to me is about not having any easy answers, not being able to rely on any kind of fundamentalist interpretation of scripture or use the authorities to tell us what to believe, but to drop all of our preconceptions about what is holy and what is sacred and even what is God and experience it directly.
And it seems like a bridge, you know, when you get beyond the what's right and what's wrong. The mysticism, which is like a tradition in basically most faiths around the world,
I think
is like a bridge that seems to connect them.
It is a bridge that connects them, beautifully said. And it does seem to freak out the fundamentalists of any religion, including atheism. and we all have our fundamentalist inclinations, I included, when we go to that place where all the distinctions dissolve and we, you know, we just are like drops of ocean in that boundless heart.
Thank you so much.
It's not safe. It's dangerous.
Thank you so much, Mirabai, for that answer. We're about halfway through the program right now. It goes by pretty quickly. Stay on the line.
Okay.
We're just going to take a quick break. You are listening to the Godspeed Institute live on the Progressive Radio Network. When we return from the break, we'll continue our conversation with Mirabai Starr, teacher, translator, and author, and we'll discuss her latest book, God of Love, in just a moment. Right now, I'm hoping to spend a couple of minutes with Hall and Oates and their new take on an old classic. Stay with us.
child, things are gonna get easier. Ooh, child, things will get brighter. Ooh, child, things are gonna get easier. Ooh, child, things will get brighter.
What was coming undone?
Someday
we'll tie it all tighter.
Someday
we can lay in the rays of a beautiful sun.
Someday
the sky will be brighter.
Ooh, child, things are gonna be easier. Ooh, child, things will be brighter. Things are gonna be easier. Ooh, child, things will be brighter.
Someday
it won't be long when I see you again.
Someday
the time will be tighter.
Someday
we'll lose the blues and the hurt in your heart.
Someday.
Ooh, child, things are gonna be easier. Ooh, child, things will be brighter.
Welcome back to the Godspeed Institute. You are live with CARE, and we're speaking with teacher, translator, and author Mirabai Starr about mysticism and the relationship between faiths. Her latest book is God of Love, A Guide to the Heart of Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. Mirabai, in this part of the program, I'd like to explore your book a little more deeply now. The Abrahamic faiths are publicly portrayed as being at the center of conflict and competition in our world, as we've discussed, and therefore attached to ideas of violence and territorialism. But according to you, what is at the heart of these three interrelated religions?
By the way, if anyone can come up with an alternative to Abrahamic, that would be great. Because
that's the beginning?
Yeah. I just, it's such a patriarchal term. And there was Sarah, and they were all the matriarchs. And anyway, just
no, go ahead.
Pet peeve I have. I haven't thought of one yet.
Oh, okay.
There's got to be one. So maybe some. Maybe one of your listeners
will
come
up. Part of the problem is calling them that.
I know. I'm wondering. Monotheistic also, is true, but it has a kind of elitism attached to it that I also have trouble with in terms of the inclusivity that I'm really trying to emphasize.
Yeah.
But I certainly am not the first, and I hope will not be the last, to notice that Judaism, Christianity, and Islam are all not only rooted in the same kind of common revelation of the oneness of God, that is the oneness of all that is, but that they have very, very specific ethical teachings and teachings regarding stewardship of the earth, as well as mystical teachings in common. And so I went to many different texts, but primarily the sacred scriptures, looking for those common passages that unite the three traditions, and it's very easy to find. I mean, it was time consuming, but it's all there. And very little at the heart of these three traditions that's in conflict. And so I looked for categories, and I mean, I determined categories and then looked for scriptures that were in each of these categories that were similar. So the way I divided God of Love was into 12 chapters, and they're the first half more or less has to do with ethics and the earth, and the second half has more to do with mysticism, which to me is really grounded in love and longing for God. And so it's kind of
very
a combination.
Strongly running in all those faiths.
Yeah, in all three faiths. So the book is kind of following two streams, how we treat one another as a reflection of our relationship with God's stream, you know, that is ethics and stewardship of the earth, and the other stream is this mystical stream of longing for that, for God, union with God, that sense of separation and longing to return to our divine source, which I suggest, and I'm not alone, is love.
Oh, yes. No, I know. We, at some point in our history here, spoke with Rabbi Michael Ox, I believe, who has an organization, Chai, C-H-A-I.
Uh-huh.
And it's specifically for the, as he calls the children of Abraham, all three faiths to come together and study together. And he said, we study in tears because of the closeness that's actually there. Mm-hmm. You know, it's almost like you're realizing, my gosh, you know, I'm struggling with my brother.
Yes.
Or sister.
How wonderful.
You know,
that's what I mean. I know I'm not alone. There are many of us doing this work right now. And you know, somehow I was given the blessing of a voice because of my work with translating the Christian mystics as a Jew. You know, a Jew translating the Christian mystics kind of opened up a space for me to be able to speak in my own voice. And God of Love is my first book in my own voice, and it was very exciting to be able to step up and report on some of the connections that I've been able to make through this deep interaction with these sacred texts of all traditions.
And it, as you found in Scripture, what are some of the principles or some of the core you know, components at the heart? I mean, imagine the heart itself is one.
Yes, exactly, Care. Well said. Yes, the heart being the foundation of the home base for all of these teachings and all these traditions is definitely one of them. The essential unity, the radical oneness that is at the message of each of these traditions, that not only there is only one God, it's not like there's one God and all the other gods are lesser. It's that there is only one divine reality. And most really serious Muslims will say that's all they're trying to say, is that it's not that our God is better than your God. It's that there is only one reality, and we call it God for lack of a better, or we call it Allah, or we call it whatever we may call it, Adonai, but it's what we're affirming is that which transcends all description and yet unifies everything and is could also be called love. But some of the other themes would be, as I mentioned, stewardship of the earth, the fact that all three, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, call us to take responsibility for our place in creation and for the intelligence and power that we have to be able to use it wisely in harmony with the other creatures and the environment that supports us. Another is the prophetic call. I talk a lot about prophets in each of the traditions, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, and how the prophets are often reluctant, but are called to stand up and speak what's coming through them, often at their own expense. And I really suggest that we're all prophets and that we're all demanded to speak truth to power sometimes, even when it's uncomfortable and inconvenient and embarrassing. I talk about the stranger and how the Abrahamic faiths are very much grounded in welcoming the stranger. You know, in the Jewish texts it says you must treat the stranger among you with kindness because you too were a stranger in Egypt, and so on. So there's this recognition that those who don't look like us and don't act like us and don't believe what we believe are potentially angels of God and must be treated with kindness and love and respect. And there are some great stories about how Abraham modeled that behavior of welcoming the stranger. I tell a lot of stories in God of Love, Bible stories, stories from the Quran, and also stories from my own life and people I've met along the way who I feel really exemplify these various teachings, like forgiveness and reconciliation or compassionate action, meaning how do we have work in the world that is right livelihood, as the Buddhists call it, that does no harm and in fact fosters peace and mends the fabric, the torn fabric of human relations. Mm. So these are the kinds of things. And I also talk about the great passionate stories of love in the different traditions, from the Song of Songs to the poetry of the 4th century Sufi poet Rabia, and all of, and the Baal Shem Tov, and all of these great, wild, God-intoxicated beings who have left us traces of their encounter with love.
Yes, and I'd like to ask you about that, the kind of people whose lives you explore in the book, examples like Dorothy Day,
mm-hmm.
and as you just mentioned, Baal Shem Tov and Sufi Rabia, from the different traditions. Can you share a little bit about why you selected these particular folks?
Mm-hmm. Yes, it was hard to pick some and not others because there are so many wonderful exemplars of the unifying teachings of Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. It kind of goes back to the way I grew up and the things that I was exposed to, some of the great Sufi mystics, and also these progressive, radical, social justice-oriented Catholic teachers, both
Definitely
living
Dorothy
and not
Day's
living.
In there, yeah.
What?
Definitely Dorothy Day falls among them.
Yes, she's really the great guru of, in many ways, of the Catholic social justice movement. And I've met many of the contemporary peace and justice-oriented Catholic teachers, like Daniel Berrigan.
Right.
And they've had a tremendous influence on me, and I've spent time in their communities, like Jonah House in Baltimore, where the people who live there in community and fellowship have a Catholic practice at their core, but are completely ecumenical and embrace all paths to God and put their bodies into the gospel teachings, meaning they break into missal bases and pour their blood onto weapons of mass destruction in symbolic protest of. Actually, they call these actions plowshares actions based on the teachings of Isaiah, the prophet Isaiah, who spoke about a time when we would beat our swords into plowshares and study war no more. And they're doing it. They're protesting and they're going to prison. And, many of these people are like in their 70s and 80s now, and they're still doing it, chaining themselves to the Pentagon fence. And I'm so inspired by these people because it's so easy for me personally. As I mentioned, I have these kind of monastic inclinations. I sit in meditation every day, and I walk in the woods every day, and it's so easy for me to go into that very personal, private place of prayer and to keep showing up and bearing witness to the suffering of the world. It's a constant practice of awareness, and it's where it matters, I think. I mean, it's really easy to cultivate your own inner life. Well, maybe not so easy, but if it's not contributing to the alleviation of suffering, then what value does it have? But that takes rigorous discipline to keep showing up in this broken world.
Yes, yes. And I just want to go back a little to the people in the book, for like as we were saying, Dorothy Day, who was like a founder of the Catholic Worker Movement.
Yes.
Still somewhat of a controversial, solitary figure to this day. Now, tell us a little bit about the Jewish mystic Baal Shem Tov.
Well, what's really interesting is that the whole Hasidic Jewish movement has become in many ways more conservative than Orthodox Judaism,
right.
But the Baal Shem Tov originally was a complete revolutionary and was defying all of the kind of conservative aspects of Jewish theology and celebrating the ecstatic encounter with the God of love. And so he would sing and dance with the Torah and break into these ecstatic poetic moments that were completely shocking to the orthodoxy of his time. Mm. And yet, as I said, the Hasidic Jewish movement in different parts of the world has become also quite entrenched in their own version of orthodoxy. But the Baal Shem Tov himself was a radical ecstatic who would go into states of complete rapture in relationship to the Torah and to the teachings and to God himself / herself. There's also an emphasis on the feminine face of the divine in Jewish mysticism, the Shekhinah, which is the indwelling feminine aspect of the divine reality. And the Jewish renewal movement, spearheaded by Reb Zalman Schachter Shalomi, really beautifully illustrates these kind of more mystical and ecstatic teachings of the Jewish tradition, exemplified by the Baal Shem Tov, including the feminine. But he was very controversial. But the other thing about the Baal Shem Tov, in addition to being an ecstatic mystic, was that he was also a very humble and practical human being. And I tried to pick human beings as my exemplars throughout this book who we could relate to, not some kind of mythic right. creatures who were beyond all of us in every way, so saintly that we couldn't possibly hope to emulate them, right. but people who struggled and suffered and made mistakes and were embodied, yeah. you know, in many cases, had relationships, had their hearts broken, had children, lost children,
yeah.
and people who, like us, were doing the best they could to face the human condition with love and with caring and with humility, and to keep continuing to open and open and open to what is true rather than what we wish or want to be true.
Mm, thank you so much for that answer. And now then, Sufism as the like mystical tradition of Islam, why did you select Rabia?
To tell you the truth, I was trying to find women.
Yes.
As much as I could, because the Abrahamic faiths are dominated by men, even now. I mean, even translators of the mystics are almost all men. So I was really looking deep to make sure that I was representing the feminine throughout this book. And so I've always loved Rabia because she's such a wild one. I mean, she lived in the desert and slept on a stone for her pillow and carried a broken clay pot for her food. These are not light, fluffy, feel-good kind of mystics. These are people who burned for truth. And so Rabia was a beautiful example, I think, of that burning for God, burning for truth.
Now, how do you weave them together, though, which I imagine is the point of your book, is, you know, to show the commonalities, to show the fires, the passions, as you say, the heart and the love. How do the lives, you know, these different lives come together to, like, open up doors for us?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, just to repeat, I am using each of these people as exemplars of a particular theme that Judaism, Christianity, and Islam have in common. So at the end of each chapter, I pick a particular exemplar to illumine that topic. So whether it's stewardship of the earth or welcoming the stranger or longing for God or faith in the absence of proof or the power of doubt, I'll pick someone who I think exemplifies that, but also could easily do it for any of the other traditions. Like they happen to be representatives of a particular one, either right. Judaism, Christianity, or Islam, but could easily be speaking for all of them. Mm. And as I also said, I want them to be relatable. Like these are people like us who struggled and suffered and weren't always graceful under fire.
Now, what do you hope for the reader to take away from God of Love?
Well, one of my main wishes is to offer some kind of antidote to Islamophobia. That contemporary American culture has such an anti-Islamic view based on television, based on what they see on Fox News or even in more mainstream media outlets, even in the newspaper, even, you know, well-meaning Jewish people I know who just assume that every Muslim wants to wipe us off the face of the earth. And,
yeah.
And Sufism, the mystical aspect of Islam, as you pointed out, is so different from that. Sufism emphasizes love as the common element in all the world's religious traditions. If anything, I probably am most influenced by Sufi teachings in my work. And as a Jew who translates the Christian mystics, Islam has been a powerful doorway for me into the heart. Now, it's true that mainstream Islam, fundamentalist Islam, just like fundamentalist anything, isn't necessarily going to give us that picture, but the Sufi teachings very much do and are well worth looking at. When my students find out about Sufism in the classroom, I also do a lot of field trips and bring in guests, and they're always just amazed and delighted by the beauty that's there in Islam. And it's in the scriptures, too. Some of the most poetic, evocative, moving scriptures of all are in the Quran.
Hmm.
And some of the most violent, horrifying scriptures are in the Old Testament.
Yeah.
Which we conveniently overlook.
Yes. I know. And a lot of Christians have a little difficulty making sense of moving into the New Testament.
Yeah.
Like, the same person.
The New Testament is sort of the most benign of them all.
Yeah. Yes. Well, I appreciate what you're sharing, because this is significant. You know, what you're offering to people and what you'd like them to gain from it. And
what
right,
I'd like
it's
them
right
to
on
gain
time
is...
in terms of how the classic, you know, ageless, eternal mystics can point so well to what is happening right now in this time in this place.
Isn't that true?
And what we're struggling with is just. You know, God of Love is just—it's right on time for what we need so much today. Now, what do you perceive as the way forward here in terms of the Abrahamic faiths? I mean, once we get behind, give them a new name.
Yeah, right.
Let's get over that hump. What do you think is ahead here? How do we move forward?
Well, and it connects with what my deepest wish is for the offering that this book might make, which is to for each of us to learn to love the other faith traditions, not only to tolerate them, but to fall in awe at their beauty. And so I want people to be Christians to read about Judaism and Islam and go, really? I didn't know that. That is so beautiful. I love that.
Mm.
And really the difference between interspirituality and the traditional interfaith movement is that interspirituality is about not just learning about each religion and tolerating it, but having a direct heart experience of other faith traditions.
Mm.
So I'm really encouraging people in this book, if you're Christian, go to a Jewish high holiday service and allow yourself to take in that ancient Hebrew liturgy and feel it in the cells of your body and see if it opens a space for you of love.
Mm.
If you're Jewish, see if you can participate in a Muslim ritual of some kind or have a heart-to-heart talk with a Muslim who loves God with all her heart and soul and might, and see if you can find a way not only to accept other ways of looking at God and the world, but to do a chant in that tradition and let it transform you, let it change you, let that encounter make a difference in your life.
Mm, that is so lovely. Thank you so much for that, Mirabai. And I relate to what the distinction you just made, because you know the interfaith and ecumenical movement are also terms I've been very familiar with for some decades too.
Mm,
but
right.
I once called ecumenical, it just means alone together.
Mm,
because of exactly that, because of that was what was not happening, people not in really engaging.
Yeah.
And learning and falling in love with, the others.
And tasting through the practices, doing the practices that are engineered over millennia to transform consciousness. It's not just an intellectual experience. It's a spiritual experience when you can do the practices of other traditions and feel that love in your heart.
Mm. Well, thank you so much, Mirabai. As we come to the end of the program, I just want to let listeners know that all of your website and contact information will be posted on our homepage shortly at GodspeedInstitute.com, including where people can find your writings and your new book, God of Love. I just want to thank you so much for being on the program today.
Thank you, Kara. It was wonderful talking with you. It just felt like having a conversation with the best of myself.
Oh, my goodness. Mm-hmm. Thank you. That's lovely. Yes, I definitely feel we're sisters at mm-hmm. heart, and I'm so glad to have met you, even in this way, on the airwaves. Please stay in touch.
Great.
All right. And listeners, thank you for joining us for the Godspeed Institute today. This program was recorded live on the Progressive Radio Network in New York City and produced by Michael Hallenbeck. Our guest was Mirabai Starr. The Godspeed Institute is an independent educational organization dedicated to promoting religious tolerance and celebrating the value of spiritually based living. If you'd like to hear this or any of our previous programs again or send it to someone, simply go to GodspeedInstitute.com. Please send your comments to office@GodspeedInstitute.com. We always enjoy hearing from you. And join us again as we continue to explore all the world's religions and spiritual belief systems right here at 2 o'clock Eastern Time every Sunday at PRN.FM. Until then, we wish you Godspeed on your journey.